Chapter 43. Bear, blank J. Blank, was hanged for highway robbery, is a brutal and gratuitous lie, without a shadow of foundation in fact. It is disheartening to virtuous men to see such shameful means resorted to achieve political success as the attacking of the dead in their graves, and defiling their honored names with slander. When we think of the anguish this miserable falsehood must cause the innocent relatives and friends of the deceased, we are almost driven to incite an outraged and insulted public to summary and unlawful vengeance upon the traducer. But no. Let us leave him to the agony of a lacerated conscience, though if passion should get the better of the public, and in its blind fury they should do the traducer bodily injury, it is but too obvious that no jury could convict and no court punish the perpetrators of the deed. The ingenious closing sentence had the effect of moving me out of bed with dispatch that night, and out at the back door also, while the outraged and insulted public surged in the front way, breaking furniture and windows in their righteous indignation as they came, and taking off such property as they could carry when they went. And yet I can lay my hand upon the book, and say that I never slandered Mr. Blank's grandfather. More. I had never even heard of him, or mentioned him up to that day and date. I will state, in passing, that the journal above quoted from always referred to me afterward as Wayne, the Body Snatcher. The next newspaper article that attracted my attention was the following. A sweet candidate. Mr. Mark Twain, who was to make such a blighting speech at the mass meeting of the Independents last night, didn't come to time. A telegram from his physician stated that he had been knocked down by a runaway team, and his leg broken in two places, sufferer lying in great agony, and so forth, and a lot more bosh of the same sort. And the Independents tried hard to swallow the wretched subterfuge, and pretend that they did not know what was the real reason of the absence of the abandoned creature whom they denominate their standard bearer. A certain man was seen to reel into Mr. Twain's hotel last night in a state of beastly intoxication. It is the imperative duty of the Independents to prove that this besotted brute was not Mark Twain himself. We have them at last. This is a case that admits of no shirking. The voice of the people demands in thundertones, who was that man? It was incredible, absolutely incredible, for a moment, that it was really my name that was coupled with this disgraceful suspicion. 3 long years had passed over my head since I had tasted ale, beer, wine or liquor or any kind. It shows what effect the times were having on me when I say that I saw myself, confidently dubbed Mr. Delirium Tremens Twain in the next issue of that journal without a pang, notwithstanding I knew that with monotonous fidelity the paper would go on calling me so to the very end. By this time anonymous letters were getting to be an important part of my mail matter. This form was common, how about that old woman you kiked of your premises which was Beijing? Paul. Pry. And this. There is things which you have done which is unbeknownst to anybody but me. You better trot out a few dots, to yours truly, or you'll hear through the papers from Andy Andy. This is about the idea. I could continue them till the reader was surfeited, if desirable. Shortly the principal Republican journal convicted me of wholesale bribery, and the leading Democratic paper ailed an aggravated case of blackmailing to me. In this way I acquired 2 additional names, : Twain the filthy corruptionist and Wayne the loathsome embracer. By this time there had grown to be such a clamor for an answer to all the dreadful charges that were laid to me, that the editors and leaders of my party said it would be political ruin for me to remain silent any longer. As if to make their appeal the more imperative, the following appeared in one of the papers the very next day. Behold the man. The independent candidate still maintains silence. Because he dare not speak. Every accusation against him has been amply proved, and they have been indorsed and re-indorsed by his own eloquent silence, till at this day he stands forever convicted. Look upon your candidate, independence. Look upon the infamous perjurer, the Montana thief, the body snatcher. Contemplate your incarnate delirium tremens, your filthy corruptionist, your loathsome embracer. Gaze upon him, ponder him well, and then say, if you can give your honest votes to a creature who has earned this dismal array of titles by his hideous crimes, and dares not open his mouth in denial of any one of them. There was no possible way of getting out of it, and so, in deep humiliation, I set about preparing to swear a mass of baseless charges and mean and wicked falsehoods. But I never finished the task, for the very next morning a paper came out with a new horror, a fresh malignity, and seriously charged me with burning a lunatic asylum with all its inmates, because it obstructed the view from my house. This threw me into a sort of panic. Then came the charge of poisoning my uncle to get his property, with an imperative demand that the grave should be opened. This drove me to the verge of distraction. On top of this, I was accused of employing toothless and incompetent old relatives to prepare the food for the foundling hospital when I warden. I was wavering. And at last, as a due and fitting climax to the shameless persecution that party rancor had inflicted upon me, 9 little toddling children, of all shades of color and degrees of raggedness, were taught to rush onto the platform at a public meeting, and clasp me around the legs, and call me Pa. I gave it up. I hauled down my colors and surrendered. I was not equal to the requirements of a gubernatorial campaign in the state of New York, and so I sent in my withdrawal from the candidacy, and in bitterness of spirit signed it, truly yours, once a decent man, but now, Ark Twain, L.P. M. T. B. S. D. T. F. C. and L. E. A mysterious visit, the first notice that was taken of me when I edled down recently was by a gentleman who said he was an assessor and connected with the U.S. Internal Revenue Department. I said I had never heard of his branch of business before, but I was very glad to see him all the same. Would he sit down? He sat down. I did not know anything particular to say, and yet I felt that people who have arrived at the dignity of keeping house must be conversational, must be easy and sociable in company. So, in default of anything else to say, I asked him if he was opening his shop in our neighborhood. He said he was. I did not wish to appear ignorant, but I had hoped he would mention what he had for sale. I ventured to ask him how was trade? And he said oh so. I then said we would drop in, and if we liked his house as well as any other, we would give him our custom. He said he thought we would like his establishment well enough to confine ourselves to it, said he never saw anybody who would go off and hunt up another man in his line after trading with him once. That sounded pretty complacent, but barring that natural expression of villainy which we all have, the man looked honest enough. I do not know how it came about exactly, but gradually we appeared to melt down and run together, conversationally speaking, and then everything went along as comfortably as clockwork. We talked, and talked, and talked, at least I did. And we laughed, and laughed, and laughed, at least he did. But all the time I had my presence of mind about me, I had my native shrewdness turned on all head, as the engineers say. I was determined to find out all about his business in spite of his obscure answers, and I was determined I would have it out of him without his suspecting what I was at. I meant to trap him with a deep, deep ruse. I would tell him all about my own business, and he would naturally so warm to me during this seductive burst of confidence that he would forget himself and tell me all about his affairs before he suspected what I was about. I thought to myself, my son, you little know what an old fox you are dealing with. I said. Now you never would guess what I made lecturing this winter and last spring? No, don't believe I could, to save me. Let me see. About $2,000, maybe? But no, sir, I know you couldn't have made that much. Say $1,700, maybe? Ha, ha. I knew you couldn't. My lecturing receipts for last spring and this winter were $14,750. What do you think of that? Why, it is amazing, perfectly amazing. I will make a note of it. And you say even this wasn't all? All. Why, bless you, there was my income from the Daily War Whoop for 4 months about, well, what should you say to about $8,000, for instance? Say. Why, I should say I should like to see myself rolling in just such another ocean of affluence. 8,000. I'll make a note of it. Why, man. And on top of all this, am I to understand that you had still more income? Ha, ha, ha. Why, you're only in the suburbs of it, so to speak. There's my book, The Innocents Abroad, price $3. $5.50 to $5, according to the binding. Listen to me. Look me in the eye. During the last 4 months and a half, saying nothing of sales before that, but just simply during the 4 months and a half, we've sold 95,000 copies of that book. 95,000. Think of it. Average $4 a copy, say. It's nearly $400,000, my son. I get half. The suffering Moses. I'll set that down. 14,758,200. Total, say, well, upon my word, the grand total is about $213,000 or $214,000. Is that possible? Possible. If there's any mistake, it's the other way. $214,000 cash is my income for this year, if I know how to cipher. Then the gentleman got up to go. It came over me most uncomfortably that maybe I had made my revelations for nothing, besides being flattered into stretching them considerably by the stranger's astonished exclamations. But no, at the last moment the gentleman handed me a large envelope, and said it contained his advertisement, and that I would find out all about his business in it, and that he would be happy to have my custom wood. In fact, be proud to have the custom of a man of such prodigious income, and that he used to think there were several wealthy men in the city, but when they came to trade with him, he discovered that they barely had enough to live on, and that, in truth, it had been such a weary age, since he had seen a rich man face to face, and talked to him, and touched him with his hands, that he could hardly refrain from embracing me. In fact, would esteem it a great favor, if I would let him embrace me. This so pleased me, that I did not try to resist, but allowed this simple-hearted stranger to throw his arms about me, and weep a few tranquilizing tears down the back of my neck. Then he went his way. As soon as he was gone, I opened his advertisement. I studied it attentively for 4 minutes. I then called up the cook, and said, "Hold me while I faint. Let Marie turn the griddle cakes." By and by, when I came to, I sent down to the rum mill on the corner, and hired an artist by the week, to sit up nights and curse that stranger, and give me a lift occasionally in the daytime, when I came to a hard place. Ah, what a miscreant he was. His advertisement was nothing in the world, but a wicked tax return, a string of impertinent questions about my private affairs, occupying the best part of 4 fool's cap pages of fine print questions, I may remark, gotten up with such marvelous ingenuity, that the oldest man in the world couldn't understand what the most of them were driving at, questions to, that were calculated to make a man report about 4 times his actual income, to keep from swearing to a falsehood. I looked for a loophole, but there did not appear to be any. Inquiry number 1 covered my case as generously and as amply as an umbrella could cover an anthill. What were your profits, during the past year, from any trade, business, or vocation, wherever carried on? And that inquiry was backed up by 13 others of an equally searching nature, the most modest of which required information as to whether I had committed any burglary or highway robbery, or, by any arson or other secret source of emolument, had acquired property which was not enumerated in my statement of income as set opposite to inquiry number 1. It was plain that stranger had enabled me to make a goose of myself. It was very, very plain. And so I went out and hired another artist. By working on my vanity, the stranger had seduced me into declaring an income of $214,000. By law, $1,000 of this was exempt from income tax, the only relief I could see, and it was only a drop in the ocean. At the legal 5%, I must pay to the government the sum of $10,650, income tax. I may remark, in this place, that I did not do it. I am acquainted with a very opulent man, whose house is a palace, whose table is regal, whose outlays are enormous, yet a man who has no income, as I have often noticed by the revenue returns, and to him, I went for advice in my distress. He took my dreadful exhibition of receipts, he put on his glasses, he took his pen, and presto, I was a pauper. It was the neatest thing that ever was. He did it simply by deftly manipulating the bill of deductions. He set down my state, national, and municipal taxes at so much, my losses by shipwreck, fire, etc. at so much, my losses on sales of real estate on livestock sold on amends for rent of homestead on repairs, improvements, interest on previously taxed salary as an officer of the United States Army, Navy, Revenue Service, and other things. He got astonishing deductions out of each and every one of these matters, each and every one of them. And when he was done, he handed me the paper, and I saw at a glance that during the year my income, in the way of profits, had been $1,250.40. Now, said he, the $1,000 is exempt by law. What you want to do, is to go and swear this document in and pay tax on the $250. While he was making this speech, his little boy Willie lifted a $2 greenback out of his vest pocket and vanished with it, and I would wager anything that if my stranger were to call on that little boy, tomorrow he would make a false return of his income. Do you, said I, do you always work up the deductions after this fashion in your own case, sir? Well, I should say so. If it weren't for those 11 saving clauses under the head of deductions, I should be beggared every year to support this hateful and wicked, this extortionate and tyrannical government. This gentleman stands away up among the very best of the solid men of the city, the men of moral weight, of commercial integrity, of unimpeachable Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.